You're listening to the Hour of the Time. I'm William Cooper. Ladies and gentlemen, I hope you have pen and paper. Tonight we're going to continue where we left off last night. And we're going to call this The Lost Light Number 3. I'm going to be reading to you verbatim from the 1910 Volume 12 issue of the New Age magazine, which is the official publication of the Supreme Council of the 33rd Degree of the Southern Jurisdiction of the Scottish Rite of Freemasonry. And what you're going to hear, well, it should cause you to raise an eyebrow. It should turn on light bulbs in your head. It should sound alarms. It should help you to understand how we have come to this point in time where this great nation is being destroyed from within, not from without, ladies and gentlemen. And that's the way it's always been here. So, get comfortable. Get ready. Open your mind. And once again, the bell tolls for you. I advise you to listen. The Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters, and God said, "Let there be light." And there was light. Of those who look beneath the surface of the Masonic movement, it becomes clear that this great secret fraternity is an order partly religious and moral, partly mystic, which dates back to the dim past. Indeed, there are many who claim that its stream can be traced to the fountainhead of that great hierarchy, supposed to have had its origin in India, that land to which may be attributed so many of the thought motives that sway humanity. Remember, ladies and gentlemen, I'm reading from the 1910, volume 12, January to June, New Age magazine, which is the official magazine of the Supreme Council of the 33rd Degree of the Southern Jurisdiction of the Scottish Rite of Freemasonry. Soul knowledge is what the wisest of the world have ever been seeking, and it is what they will ever be seeking, until our well-worn planet reaches dissolution. It embraces a realization of the deity in all creation and a recognition of the interrelation between God and man and between man and his brother man. Therefore, this search stands back of all the faiths and religions, and many and devious have been the roads over which the seekers have passed, each choosing the pathway best suited to his nature. For their particular glimmer of this great light, many have laid down their lives. Because of their longing for this inner vision, many have abandoned the world and lived in monasteries or deserts or have isolated themselves in mountain fastnesses. It matters not whether we examine the records of pagan or Christian countries. Everywhere we find mention of these mystics, visionaries, dreamers, who have counted the pleasures of life as gross and the hidden truth as all in all, and have groped on wisely or blindly, as the case might be, in their quest of this science of the soul. There is no doubt that but each religion caught some of the light, and with it kindled its individual torch. Afterwards, the crystallizing process of form laid stone after stone around that torch, until an impenetrable wall hemmed it on every side, and its illuminating rays were either deadened or extinguished. As we pass in review all the beliefs, facets, denominations which have arisen and waned, we know that the way of each was too limited, and the man-made dogma more prized than the spirit within. Thus, as we move back through the ages, granting the good here and the pity of it all there, we stand at last before the fountainhead, the great wisdom. It limits neither breadth nor scope of any man. It allows to everyone the fullest soul development of what he is capable. Following it, all must grow. This ancient theosophy may be regarded as the source of God knowledge and of soul knowledge. From it extends the chain that can be followed link by link through all the religious creeds, humanitarian movements, and secret societies. It is the sacred bond connecting one with another, beginning with the spiritual hierarchy, considered by students of the Orient as a grand communion of perfect souls. This great wisdom has flowed steadily on. From it have come the sons of God, the saviors of the world. And ladies and gentlemen, that will give you some indication of what they believe themselves to be and why they believe that it is them that must decide the future of all humanity and not us whom they call the profane. I continue. These progressive ones have been the founders of all religious belief, and the reason of its diversity lies in the fact that the inner secret has been revealed only so far as the receiver could understand. We find Christ stating to his apostles, "I have many things. I have many things to say unto you, but ye cannot bear them now." While old Jewish records claim that the chapter on creation was to be expounded to only one hearer. Thus we learn that the great mysteries were always preserved for the enlightened few who could hold and follow the truth in all purity and were destined to become the teachers of mankind. According to the Reverend Dr. Oliver, Freemasonry was the great original system through which the Spirit of God moved among the sons of men and by which the soul climbed up to God. We find him making this assertion, quote, "The mysteries of all nations were originally the same and diversified only by accidental circumstances of local situation and political economy," end quote. Now this same authority states that many signs and symbols of the rites of Freemasonry have been discovered among the remaining landmarks of the antediluvian world. He believes it to have been practiced at the attempted erection of the Tower of Babel and at the dispersion scattered far and wide among the different settlements. Research shows that in remotest antiquity, the art of building was considered sacred and was carried on by priests. As examples of this may be cited, the Ionian architects, the Dionysian artificers, and the operative members among the Eleusinian mystics and the Pythagorean and Essenian associations. The priests and builders in these societies were always connected, and we find most of the famous ruins of the past ascribed to the Ionian and Dionysian artisans and artificers, while the pyramids of Egypt bear witness to the magnitude of the builder's art among the pharaohs, where the priesthood was dominant. Indeed, it is to the pastos in the king's chamber of the Great Pyramid which irresistibly leads us to a belief that Freemasonry existed among the builders and priests of Egypt, for we find the chief ceremony of the Masons typified by this pastos and are compelled to acknowledge that the doctrine implied is the same which connects the apparently distinct mysteries. All of these societies used symbols from the art of building. They were divided into lodges, characterized by different names, and they had words and signs by which they could recognize the brethren of the order. They had also high degrees and rights, which were hidden from all but the more advanced of the confederation, and were shrouded under the impenetrable mask of secrecy. They followed the same mode of instructing the ignorant by allegory, symbol, and fable. All seemed addicted to a use of amulets, talismans, and magic. They were all averse to committing their greatest secrets to writing. All were endeavoring to impress a system of morality, and lastly, all recognized immortality of the soul and a future state of rewards and punishments. This they had in common with what is now Masonry, or the science of light. Gradually, corruption crept into the practices, and the divisions grew to regard certain allegories and symbols as the chief point in the religion, and what was intended as a representative sign was changed into a god to be worshipped. But while perversion and even depravity prevailed, there were still many great souls who followed the secret inner doctrine and acted as conduits for the maintenance and flow of the river of light. Moses was himself a priest of Egypt, and there is a legend to the effect that Christ was an Essene and versed in all the learning of the Alexandrian priesthood. Buddha, Lao Tse, Zoroaster, Plato, Aristotle, Socrates, and the Gnostics all preached the sacred doctrine. The souls climb to the divine. Life, light, and love were the three steps all these teachers considered necessary. The world has not the slightest conception of half the spiritual work carried on by the mystic fraternities. Down beneath the old idolatries lay the secret doctrine, and a few great true men among the corrupted priesthood held it unpolluted in the depths of their hearts. Thus, struggling under a superstructure of evil, the great principle lay as a first cause. The Eleusinian, the Dionysian, the Ionian, and the Egyptian mysteries, as well as the religious practices of the Far Orient, were all derived from it. These priesthoods appear to have exchanged communication with each other in all ancient times, and there were certain ties between them, reaching from the fastnesses of the Indian adepts to the dim woodland retreats of the Druids. When we consider all these facts, a disturbing question arises. How did the Society of Masons free itself from this shroud of idolatry and in the end shake off the bonds of all religious form? The answer probably lies in the historically recorded fact that in the year 714 BC, in the days of Numa, a college of artisans was founded at Rome. The original members of this association were invited to come from Greece and settle in the imperial city to teach the art of building. As the Grecian builders belonged to the Eleusinian mysteries, it seems natural to suppose that men of high and noble soul and who held the secret doctrine in its purity and were distressed by the degradations it suffered at the hands of the majority of its followers, were the ones to respond to this invitation and leave their own country. When they established themselves in Rome, they brought with them the secret doctrine and formed a mystic society that had various degrees and a language of symbols drawn from their trade, but which was freer from the evil practices they had deplored in the mysteries. Transplanted in Rome, they were no longer priests, but a college of master artisans, although still connected with the priesthood by that hidden religious science which both possessed in common. The legend that Christ was an Essene has already been mentioned, and as an Essene, versed in all that secret science which aims at bringing to pass the perfection of the human race. I'm going to repeat that. Which aims at bringing to pass the perfection of the human race. He chose the most ethical of his apostles and entrusted it to them. The divine principle thus passed into the keeping of the early church of the Christian era and was handed on through the priesthood of the Church of Christ as it had been through the pagan priesthoods. The proof of this lies in the fact that many of the writings of the early church show that the fathers of the Christian religion understood and practiced occultism. Some of their most advanced thinkers, as the Abbe Lecour, even cutting themselves adrift from the institution when it insisted on the narrowing process of crystallization. Admitting the mutual possession of the same divine ethical principle, we see that when the old beliefs gave way to Christianity, the Roman artisans were connected with the new church by this hidden doctrine. Through the early ages of Christianity, we find traveling architects and builders who moved from country to country to erect the great religious edifices, and these wandering artisans were the descendants of the college founded by Numa. They called themselves traveling Freemasons. Today they call themselves fellow travelers. Now, many authentic historical statements prove that these guilds of builders in the Middle East carried on some secret religion as well as their trade and were connected with the Christian church up to the 13th century, when the narrowed dogma of the ecclesiastical body and the persecutions of these differing in tenets led the Guild of Masons, then becoming speculative instead of operative, to throw off the bondage of the church. Most authorities believe it to have been at this stage in its development that the great secret fraternity adopted the name of Freemasons and became a moral society instead of a band following a particular craft, while at the same time they retained the symbols of the trade they no longer practiced. It is proved beyond any doubt that the Emperor Rudolf I, in the year 1275, authorized an order of non-operative Masons, and in the century following, many brotherhoods of the same kind were legally established. The most generally accepted opinion is that the present body of Freemasons, which is less mystic than formerly, was rearranged in the year 1717. We find that their charter of Cologne contains this passage, quote, "The Brotherhood are the order of Freemason brothers bound together according to St. John's holy rule traces its origin neither from the Templars nor from any other spiritual or temporal knightly order, but is older than all similar orders and has long existed in Palestine and Greece as well as in various parts of the Roman Empire." End quote. And in the absolute meaning of this statement, it is correct, ladies and gentlemen. It does not trace its origin to the Templars. However, it was the Templars who brought it from the Middle East to the European continent. Through this statement, we stand again face to face with the pre-Christian secret doctrine. This growth of the Great Brotherhood through the purely Masonic channels of the Middle Ages, changing the name Freemasons when it threw off all allegiance to the Church and became non-operative, appears the best-founded theory and the one most reasonable and plausible. There are many, however, who believe that the Freemasons came into existence either through the Order of Knights Templars or else through the Rosicrucians, adopting symbols and practices copied, not inherited, from the art of building. And undoubtedly, a similarity in connection between the belief and organization of the Templars and Freemasons can easily be traced, yet there seems scarcely convincing proof that the latter developed from the former. Indeed, the burden of evidence tends to prove that the Templar growth owes its origin to the Masons. And ladies and gentlemen, that is true. As the Templars gained the knowledge of the ancient mysteries in the Middle East, brought it to Europe, and dispersed it from there. Freemasonry did not come from the Templars, yet it moved through the Templars from its original place of development in the Middle East, brought there from the Far East. I continue. These Templars were a religious and military body of knights which was founded during the First Crusade in the early years of the 12th century by Hugh de Payens and Geoffrey de Saint-Adhemar. And ladies and gentlemen, that is a false statement, a totally false statement. That just flat is not true. The Knights Templars were commissioned by the King of Jerusalem on the Temple Mount. Originally, there were only 9 knights. And they worked for many years on the Temple Mount and in the tunnels and passageways beneath the Temple Mount. Many believe that they were looking for the treasure of the old temple of Solomon that was supposedly secreted away when the Romans destroyed it. And that could be true. But the truth is they were commissioned by the King of Jerusalem. They were not a religious order. In fact, they were not accepted by the Catholic Church until many years later when they became so wealthy and so powerful that the Pope needed them as an ally. That is the truth. And if you study the history of the Templars, you will soon find that statement is the fact and not the statement in here. Hugh de Payens was the first Grand Master of the Knights Templars, but he did not found the Templars. I continue. There were 9 knights in this little band when it was first established, and they bound themselves together by the strict rule of St. Augustine. As some authorities claim that Hugh de Payens was himself a Mason, there were probably distinct Masonic features about the early ceremonies of these knights, whose chief aim was to protect the pilgrims in Palestine, and who therefore styled themselves Knights of Christ. And that also is a false statement, ladies and gentlemen. They had nothing to do with the church until the Pope summoned them and commissioned them to protect the pilgrims on their way to Palestine, which the Knights Templars seldom, if ever, did, ladies and gentlemen. Instead, they engaged themselves in battle and at times were even allies and confidants of Saladin, who was supposed to be the Muslim enemy of the Christians in the Middle East. So this account, written by a Freemason for the official tome of Freemasonry in this country, has some errors. You must take that into account in all of it. If there's one error in here, there may be more. And so far, we found 2. I continue. At this point in the Templar history, we must once more turn to that legend which claims that Jesus the Christ was an Essene and versed in all the mysteries of the Alexandrian priesthood. When he presented himself before the scribes, Pharisees, and priests in Jerusalem, it is believed that he showed them how the laws of Moses had been perverted and the secret doctrine denied by the practices and teachings of the Levites. And he tore down the veil which hid the truth from the people, and so far as they could understand, instructed them in the great principles of God and light and love. Then choosing the most trustworthy and advanced of his apostles, he committed to them what the masses could not comprehend, the secret doctrine, and placed them under his beloved disciple, Saint John. So runs this Christian legend. And that is not true either, ladies and gentlemen, because he placed them, according to the church, under his apostle Peter, if you'll remember correctly. Now, all through this, there's one thing that you should have already understood. Freemasons are not Christians. Not one Freemason in this world is a Christian if he follows the teachings and doctrines of the Freemasonic Lodge. Now, he may be a member of the lodge in the lower degrees and still go to a Christian church and consider himself to be Christian if he has done no studying of the symbols or the lessons that are taught in the lodge and is just there for material benefit or for comradeship, as some of them are. The true understanding lies at the highest degrees. And, of course, this was written by a very highly degreed member of the southern jurisdiction of the Scottish Rite of Freemasonry. I continue. Saint John was the one apostle who never left the East, and his small band of followers kept the doctrine and initiation that had been entrusted to them by the great master in all purity and wholeness, such as was not to be found in the teachings of the other apostles. And that is where the fraternal organization of Saint John of Jerusalem comes from, ladies and gentlemen. And at times, Freemasons will call themselves followers of St. John. And when they do that, you mistakenly interpret it as a declaration of Christianity. But I assure you, it is just the opposite. Now, once again, I want you all to understand, I don't care who you are. I don't care what religion you practice at all. I believe in freedom. And I believe that your ultimate judgment will be by God, not by me. Judge not, lest ye be judged. My beef is with the lies and the deceptions. My beef is with the manipulations. My beef is with the coming enslavement of the human race by these people in order to reach what they believe is the perfection of the human race. And the preservation of the natural resources of the world. Most of these are just excuses for seizing the reins of power of the world and taking over, if you will. It's the same old battle that's always been fought throughout the history of the earth, only there's more deception today than there ever has been in the history of the world. And there are more so-called educated people who are dumber than the dumbest serf who ever lived in the Dark Ages when it comes to this battle. I continue. The men of this little Eastern church styled themselves Johannite Christians and lived on in Palestine. They felt a special gratitude to Hugh de Payens and his knights for befriending the pilgrims to the Holy Lands, and so they rewarded the Templars with the treasures of knowledge they had hoarded through 1,200 years. And there's the admission that they brought the mysteries to Europe. Hugh de Payens was instructed in all the primitive teachings and ethics of Jesus, declared a patriarchal apostle, and placed in the line of succession from John the Evangelist. That it was these degrees of initiation and rules of the temples which brought the famous and terrible persecution upon the order 2 centuries later. But folks, when they talk about ethics of Jesus or ethics of the Christ, they're not talking about the Jesus of the Christian church. They're talking about a master, an ascended master, incarnated in the soul of a human to teach humanity. It is not that Jesus and not that Christ that these people are referring to. I continue. When that disastrous period arrived and most of the masters and templars of note had been tortured or burned alive, and the institution crushed by the commands of the Romish church, those templars who escaped are supposed to have taken refuge with Robert Bruce and joined the Guild of Masons in Scotland, which was through them reorganized into Freemasons. Thus it is that some authorities consider the Great Fraternity to have grown out of the Knights Templars. And that is not true. The Knights Templars brought the fraternity to Europe, and so it moved through them. It did not originate with them. It originated in the dim mists of the history of humanity. Yet, on the other hand, it is hardly credible that a powerful body like the Masons, which had weathered storms and opposition and stood the suspicion of church and state, should allow itself to be dominated and totally changed by a small band of crushed refugees. And that is their mistake. The Templars were by no means crushed. They just moved underground with all their wealth and power, and their vast fleets became the pirates that sailed the seven seas. And you all wondered where the pirate treasures went. You see, these pirates didn't just raid ships and get a few gold pieces here and there. They raided the great Spanish galleons. They raided the ships full of wealth and treasures from the east. They measured, and sailed down on every kind of ship, carrying every kind of goods and money and wealth and metals and silk that they could find. And all of this wealth vanished, ladies and gentlemen, for the pirates never were wealthy. And you visit their bastions where they all came together as brothers. Did you ever wonder why the pirates never warred amongst themselves? This wealth was funneled right back in to the Templar Order, underground and through the Masonic lodges, to work their will upon the world. And it still happens that way. Don't go away. I'll be back after this short pause. Now remember, ladies and gentlemen, if you go to your uncle or your brother or your father or your grandfather and ask them about the truth of these things, you will not be told the truth. They cannot tell you the truth. They are sworn to secrecy upon penalty of death. And if they ask them about this blood oath that they take and they tell you, well, it's just some silly oath and we just do it for ceremonial reasons. Do you really believe that? And if that's the truth, do they mean their oath that they swear upon a Bible in a court of law? Do they mean their oath if they promise you something? Or if they swear to you that something is true or false? A grown man does not give a blood oath unless he means it, ladies and gentlemen. And with the orders of co-masonry, women are included in this also, the Order of the Eastern Star and many others. So don't expect them to tell you the truth. They cannot. They cannot and will not. Yet they have written it over the years, and I have slowly but surely exposed it to you in their own writing, in their own words, over the years. These people are by far the greatest group of chronic liars that have ever lived upon the face of this earth. Manipulators, deceivers. And who is the great deceiver? I continue, everyone, however, must admit that it is extremely likely these persecuted Templars tinged some of the existing forms and ceremonies with the knowledge and practices of their order. And I can assure you that that is true. The rite of strict observance was doubtless added from their affiliation with Freemasonry, and there can be little question but that the degrees of this Templar rite were high ones, intimately connected with the mystic doctrine. Yet it is about this same rite of strict observance that there is so much controversy. The very materialistic among the Freemasons denying that it ever existed, while those more mystic by nature have no hesitation in acknowledging it. The matter is still a debatable point in the Great Brotherhood, but in their own writing passed down through the ages, there is no debate. It is clearly true. This much, however, seems clear. The Templars had a Masonic impulse back of their foundation, flourished for 200 years as a separate institution, and then returned, as it were, to the fold, a shattered remnant. Therefore, it would appear a baseless supposition that Freemasonry was derived from Templar sources. An equally untenable theory is that it was a development from the Rosicrucian Society. Again, as with the Templars, it is probable that the Rosicrucians also owed their existence to the Masonic River of Light, although in their ceremonials and practices they differed more materially. As has been previously stated, men have always been on the search for soul knowledge, and the spirit of the Rosicrucians, the mystic seekers, has existed for all known time, though not at first represented in a definite established society. This seeking necessitated the conquest of mind, body, and soul, and only those who proved by this means that they were worthy were considered fit for higher things. The Rosicrucian spirit moved by way of the secret doctrine, by way of the old religions and philosophies, and by the way of Masons and other mystic brotherhoods. We find the spirit among the Hermetic seers, the Magi, the sages of Chaldea, and the old Semitic and Chinese civilizations. Melchizedek, whom the Rosicrucians considered their first grand master, tried to show the mystic truth and rich philosophy to the multitude without regard to the fitness of the time or man. Afterwards, when he looked about him, he beheld a startling wilderness of beliefs. Certain among his followers had seized one truth, and others yet another. Each had been made into a god before which men worshipped. The purity of the teaching remained only in a few great minds. These saw that the wondrous secret doctrine could not be paraded before an ignorant multitude. They realized that it must be preserved in the hearts of the few, and so we only obtain occasional glimpses of great masters when the veil lifts a little and the Christ, the Buddha, and the other foremost religious teachers move for a while over the world stage. Yet always, wherever this veil is lifted, we see vaguely the despair that the lofty ones must suffer from the souls who will not be taught. And we recognize likewise that persecution and even the stake comes often as the reward of those who would better mankind. Thus we become aware of the reason why we so seldom catch these glimpses through the veil. Those great enough to be the world's savior are only born at rare intervals. And here you see some of their arrogance, ladies and gentlemen. If they go and teach their religion, and religion it is, and it is rejected by someone, then these are the souls who will not be taught, and those who are teaching it are suffering the rejection of these souls. Arrogant, extremely arrogant. Once again, we find a religion that condemns everyone who will not believe their dogma outright. And it is dogma, ladies and gentlemen, and like all religions, none of it can be proven. None of it at all. In fact, quite a bit of it can absolutely be proven to be false, with no problem whatsoever. by even the simplest mind. I continue. The spirit of the Rosicrucians was moving, as we have seen, through many ages. It breathed secretly among those Masons who inclined towards the mystic visions, but only came into the open when the great brotherhood dared call itself Freemasons. Then it was that Christian Rosengroups organized the society, and in 1614 or 1615 wrote the famous Fama Fraternitas. We have also seen how Masonry was at first both operative and mystic. Gradually a change took place, and in the time of the Rosengroups, the more intensely mystic of mind separated from the others and became known as Rosicrucians, while the main body left behind called themselves no longer traveling Freemasons, but Freemasons, without any qualifying term whatever. And yet, when they meet secretly or on the road or in public, one of their identifying phrases is, "Fellow traveler," or "Do you travel much?" And, of course, the answer is yes. I travel toward the east, seeking more light, and on and on and on. And this is just one of the many, many, many ways that they identify themselves to each other. It is also the same term used in communist cells, ladies and gentlemen, because they're all the same. They had lost their operative basis and became almost entirely moral and speculative, and a little later we find the Rosicrucians uniting with them by means of the secret hidden doctrine and belief in the higher initiation, which both societies held in common. P.D. Randolph tells us that there are records of Rosicrucians being admitted into Masonic lodges up to 1665, but that after that, the Masonic doors were closed a while to them, because of some impostors who had crept in. He also claims that other authentic statements show the Rosicrucians to have again been welcomed in the Masonic lodges in 1745. Thus we see the two orders mingled, separated, and mingled again, while at the same time the Rosicrucians and Freemasons were not identical. The spirit of the orders was very similar, but the societies differed in many particulars. Like various other secret fraternities in the Dark Ages, they had only moved forward side by side, sometimes touching each other, sometimes wide apart. Mackey and many Masonic writers deny that the lines ever touched, but in the face of the Rosy Cross degree so similar in both societies, this seems too strong an assertion. The fact is, ladies and gentlemen, is that the highest levels of the pyramidal structure of degrees, they're all the same order. The Rosicrucian order, established in England in 1840, was completely changed from the first true Rosicrucian body. This later society is a purely Masonic form, having lodges, initiations, and ceremonies that are entirely lacking in the former fraternity of the Holy Cross. Likewise, the three so-called Rosicrucian branches in America have no connection with the ancient order of that name. And here, he either shows an attempt at intentional deceit or pure ignorance, and if he is ignorant, he should not even be writing on the subject of the Rosicrucians, because it was never the fraternity of the Holy Cross, never in its entire history. It has always been the Fraternitas Rosicruci, which is the fraternity of the Rose Cross. And I continue again. The early Rosicrucians had no ceremonials and formal initiations. They claimed that the kinship of spirit needed no grip nor sign nor symbol to make its existence known to one of like mind. The society also admitted women to a membership on equal terms of respect. Therefore, the difference between Freemasons and Rosicrucians is clearly to be seen, although the mainspring of the great secret doctrine brought both into being. Martin Luther, ladies and gentlemen, was a member of the Rose Cross. In fact, his seal was the rose and cross. If you'll study the old documents that still exist that he signed and sealed, you will see it clearly imprinted onto the document. Considering the builders' signs and symbols of the Freemasons, and discovering that the Masons and priests were linked together in early ages, We feel that the Great Brotherhood develops through Masonic channels. For surely it would have been an act of stupidity on the part of men seeking truth and soul knowledge to encumber themselves with the builder's insignia if the signs of a trade were not their legitimate inheritance. Also, the Templar degrees of the rite of strict observance would have been pointless had there been no connection with the Knights Templars, while lastly, they could have had no claim to the degree of the Rosy Cross had they not mingled with the Rosicrucians. Undoubtedly, these men of lofty intellects would never have stooped to what would have been meaningless and absurd. So we may conclude that the signs, the symbols, the rites, and the ceremonials of the Freemasons are but as growths on the brink of the mighty Masonic stream as it followed its underground course through the Dark Ages. Each has its root in some old truth concerning the deity, nature, or man, or else represents some channel through which the river of light has moved with a steady, resistless flow towards that grand soul knowledge and the brotherhood of man. Emerson says to everyone that reaches toward the light, God has a select family of sons scattered. Through the earth, who are thy spiritual kindred, and each one, by constant device to the inward law, is weaving sublime proportion of a true I'm trying to decipher these words that are going off the page, ladies and gentlemen, if you're wondering what's happening. Of a true monarch in soul. The mighty currents of the secret doctrine come from the dimmest recesses of the past and bear these able-seeking souls on their feet, silently moving waters nearer, nearer to the perfect light. And that is the end of that tone. Also from the same issue. Even the mystics of the Middle Ages, when explaining the mystery of the fish symbol, adopted the lus, or jack, because in a mystic sense, I and B are complementary, and jack becomes iac, or back, iacus, or bacchus, an explanation that should interest Masons and Christians also, for the fish was emblematic of light to the early fathers, many of whom never laid aside their philosopher's robes upon adopting the new faith, for they saw nothing new in it beyond its divinely prepared ritual for the common use of all men. The fleur-de-lis of France is the flower of light of the ancients, even to its very form, which is Chaldean. It is the sacred lotus of Egypt and India, the emblem of the Trinity. Take down your dictionary and consider such words as the following. Luscus, Latin from the Greek, partly blind. Lustro, to make light. Lustrate, to purify, to offer purifactory sacrifice. Lucubrate, to study by light. Lumen, luna, from lucina, the moon. Lucid, to make clear or light. Illustrate, illuminate, luxury. The ramifications of these words is well nigh innumerable. The Latin word lumen, or luna, alone is the root of many coined words in which light is involved, such as the word for lamp. The apparently haphazard selection of examples given should demonstrate the remarkable ancestry and kinship of the Masonic hail, without further citation, but lest we may lose sight of that which we hail or conceal, let us lucubrate a bit over the philosophy of light as known to the ancients. Deity was conceived to be omnipresent in the smallest as well as in the greatest of creation, his spirit or divine fire, force, or whatever it may be called, filled the receptacle to the brim. The entire universe was thought to be immersed in the divine essence, as it were, much as we are immersed in the ether. This conception of God was called Brahm by the Hindus and Abram by the Arabians. The Hindu priests were called Brahmins, or priests of Brahm. The Latin priests were called Flamens, deriving the term from the same source as lumen, probably. Flamen and Brahmin are identical terms and cognate. Even in symbolism, we find lion, the symbol of strength, traced through Latin and Greek Leo to Hebrew, Egyptian, and Coptic sources, called by the name Hor, or Har, light in Egypt, because it was the symbol of that god, the symbol of the sun, Ra, or our. If now we consider why priests were called Brahmins in Egypt, we find that Brahm was born from the same brilliant egg of gold that Phra, or Ptah, the Egyptian creator, emerged from. Phra, or Phra, was the creator who emerged from the egg laid by the serpent Neph, American Maya Kan, K-A-N, and was colored blue, being girded around the middle to represent the heavens and the earth. This legend, well known to Masonic students, depicts the creation of man himself from his embryonic stage in the human egg until he has passed through the evolutionary stages of insect, reptile, and the like to that of the human being who emerges from the waters and breaks the shell. Wherever we turn in the realms of mythology, etymology, religion, or mystery, we will meet with this same injunction, know thyself. The ancient mysteries, as well as the modern, were designed with that purpose in view. To bring the candidate to light in the temple of light was to elevate him to the plane of El. And if you've studied the Bible, you should know who El is, shouldn't you? So their goal is to become God. As I have always told you. Look within your heart, ladies and gentlemen. Ask yourself, are you God? Are you ever going to be God? I'm going to tell you right now, the best you could ever hope to do is to lead a good life and help other people and try to make the world better for those who follow. If you really think that you're God, make me a universe. One better than this one. One without pain and suffering and wars. One without bigots and liars. One without conspirers and complainers and loafers and welchers. Make me that universe. Show it to me. And then and only then will I believe that you are God or can ever become God. I remember watching on television Shirley MacLaine spinning around on the beach with her arms in the air declaring, I am God! I am God! I am God! She was younger then, didn't have so many lines in her face, wasn't facing the pain in her joints and the mysterious little twinges and quirks of old age, and her hair wasn't falling out then. I wonder, ladies and gentlemen, what she's going to say tomorrow morning when she gets out of bed and makes her way to the bathroom and looks in the mirror. I wonder, will she once again stand up on her toes and twirl around and proclaim, I am God. I am God. I am God. And surely if you're listening, I mean nothing personal, but you see so many people watch you and you are a celebrity and they tend to foolishly believe what you so foolishly attempted to teach them. I only mean you well. I only mean everyone well, and that's why I do this nightly. So that we can come together in reality peacefully. As true brothers and sisters, out in the open, in the light of day, not in the dark light of a lodge, behind closed doors with no windows, with phony incantations and circumambulations around some altar, obeying the master who sits in the chair in the east. No, I want a world of real light, sunlight, and truth, and real brotherhood, free from the lies and deceptions and manipulations of those arrogant men who have fallen into the deception of their own conceit and believe that they are the masters of the rest of us. Good night, ladies and gentlemen, and God bless each and every single one of you. Remember, ladies and gentlemen, there's only one thing, one uniting common bond amongst all humanity, and that is to try to understand your neighbor, to live in freedom and give your neighbor the same freedom you expect for yourself, and to be willing to die for that, for if you're not, you will not long possess it. And you can never aspire to have it.
Somebody I adore. I'm looking over.